David, you like food?
Oh yeah, I think you know. I think you could tell.
This is a good one because I think we have arguably one of the best chefs in the world. And that's not an exaggeration. This guy, I want everybody to watch if they haven't yet, on Disney Plus, the documentary Wolfgang. It's really fantastic. His life is so interesting, so fascinating, and he's overcome a lot of adversity to get to where he is. Wolfgang Puck has been a friend of mine for many years. I'm going to say 30 years. You know, like when I first came to L.A., started going to Spago, and I sought him out. This was before even any success I had in TV. I was just like a fan. And he saw me as like a regular, and we just started talking. And then, you know, lucky enough to have success with Raymond, and we'd have all our parties there. We had all our birthdays there. We had the kids' birthdays there. The Emmy parties, of course, were always there. And of course, he does the Oscars. I think he gets underestimated because he's so famous, because that people think, oh, he's frozen pizza guy or something. They forget what a phenomenal chef he is. So I'm thrilled to explore a little of his world today.
And we're doing it with an organization I'm thrilled to stand with often. They're the Environmental Media Association. We filmed this in front of an audience at the Environmental Media Summit. It's a group that I got in sync with when they gave an award to Justin Timberlake, and I worked with him on the speech, and I wasn't even at the event, but the head of the organization, Debbie Levin, whose cell phone I believe goes off sometime in this episode, she called me and said, I love this speech, you should write our show.
Nice.
And I've been working with them on events ever since. That's many, many, many years ago.
A great, important organization with a great, important chef.
Let's spill the beans, chew the fat, food for thought and jokes on tap. Talking with our mouths full, having fun. A piece of cake and humble pie, serving up a slice of life. Leave the dressing on the side, it's naked lunch. Clothing optional.
We're so happy to be here. Tell our podcast audience, these nice people know why they're here, but tell people about Emma.
Emma, which friends know it as Emma, the Environmental Media Association, is a great organization, great environmental advocacy group that works in the entertainment business, and I've worked with them for more than 10 years, thanks to Justin Timberlake.
Yes.
Who was getting an award and called me and asked me to write a speech. I couldn't be there because I was at the much less environmental Scream Awards. And I got a call from Debbie Levin, who is here, and got to know Debbie and Asher, and that's how I ended up working on many of their events, the Emma Awards, which are amazing, now the Emma Summit. So that's Emma.
Great. And today, we are very, very happy. I have a long-term relationship with this young man. He is probably the best-known chef in the world and one of the greatest, if not the greatest, chefs in the world. You are lucky that he's here. He has a new restaurant on the roof of this Pendry Hotel, and his name is Wolfgang Puck. Here he is.
All right. Hello.
Wolfgang.
All right.
I love this man. Have
a
seat.
Thank you. Well, it's so good to be in my own home.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah, I travel most of the time. Just got back from Vienna and Budapest.
Yeah.
Finally, I'm home here.
Beautiful.
Anybody needs a room upstairs? I have some empty ones.
We could lie down after.
Okay.
You came to LA what year?
Before you were born. 1975.
Right. And I want.
Is it before you were born?
You're very sweet. You're very sweet. No, okay. I'm old. When you came here, there wasn't much of a restaurant scene. I think that's fair to say.
I think there was a restaurant scene, but totally different. You know, you had these continental restaurants where the waiters were in tuxedo, and if you didn't pronounce Chevrolet Chambertin the right way, they looked down on you and said, "Don't you know anything about food?"
Right.
You know, and everybody wanted their pasta cooked well done and their steaks cooked well done.
Yes.
And I think I remember when I came, I tried to undercook the fish a little bit, you know, because today it's totally normal.
Yeah.
And I remember one customer send it back and says, Wolfgang, you don't know how to cook fish. I said, what do you mean? She said, look, I can see it's a little undercooked. I said, that's the way it should be. Right. And I remember one time, Lauren Pacall, you know, you probably remember her, you're old enough.
Lauren Pacall, yes.
She came and she was ordering a squab.
Yeah.
We had a squab dish at the Old Spargo on the menu. And I said, I cooked one and I waited and I said, shit, it's fucking too cooked. So what did I do? I make a new one to make it perfectly pink. She walks up with her plate and said, Wolfgang, you don't know how to cook a squab right. So that's how bad it was at that time.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Who was she the biggest pain in the neck? Who was the biggest?
No. We loved her.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was a good customer. And
tough cookie, though.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. British. If she didn't get it right, yeah. I don't know. No wonder Humphrey Bogart went early, I think. So.
I want everyone to see the documentary.
The Disney Plus documentary.
It's called Wolfgang, and it's the story of Wolfgang Puck. It is so fantastic. I just watched it last night. It's so beautiful, and I know you now for many years, but there's stories in there that I did not know. David, what struck you the most about the documentary?
What struck me was it really the personal and emotional story of how you sustain in life and how you sustain a career. That's what came through so well. And I've witnessed you working, and I've sort of had a sense of what an amazing person you are, but this documentary shows that. So I guess that's what stuck with me is, how do you have sustained, you haven't just been this great chef. There are great chefs for a few years, for a decade.
Yes.
But decade after decade, you have remained a definition of excellence in the food world and in life. How have you done that?
Well, I tell everybody I'm only at the beginning. So they said, oh, you had such a great career. I said, what do you mean a great career? I'm just starting.
Yeah, put me out to pasture yet.
When they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award and, you know, this speech, I just kept it very simple. I said, this is the first time you give a Lifetime Achievement Award to somebody because you must know the future. You know, I don't know. I'm just beginning. So
You are. I'm so, as a fan of yours, I love hearing that because I want a lot more food from you. And I just was amazed at your upbringing. For those of you who don't know, you were born in Austria and you had an, I think it's fair to say, evil stepfather.
Yep.
And he was abusive and he gave you a very low sense of self-esteem. And to the point where you literally, as a young teenager, literally thought about suicide.
Yeah.
It's so bad where he comes from and where he went is a miracle, isn't it? Does it ever feel like a miracle to you?
You know, I often think, why me?
Yes.
And, you know, I was standing on this bridge where I thought I'm going to jump into the river. And
how old were you?
14.
Yeah.
Yeah, I left my home when I was 14 years old because my stepfather was crazy, you know, totally bipolar and abusive to my sister and abusive to me and everything. And I couldn't wait to get out of the house. And I moved 50 miles away. And then I started my apprenticeship in the kitchen. And then the chef, a month later, told me I'm good for nothing, just like my stepfather. And I said, and he told me, actually, go back home to your mother. And I said, I'm not going home. I much rather go to hell or to heaven. So I was standing on the river looking down and saying, okay, I think this is the end. And then all of a sudden, a light bulb went up and said, I'm just going to go back tomorrow and see what happened. And, you know, the apprentice who was there above me was so excited that he hit me in the cellar. And I was peeling vegetables and onions and all that stuff. And then the chef came down and grabbed me and says, get out of here. You know, I fired you 2 weeks ago. And I was hiding for 2 weeks in the cellar there. And then he called the owner. And the owner sent me to another hotel they owned in town. And there they had the woman who was the chef. And she was a little more understanding. You know, she was nice to me and everything. She says, just shut up and do your work and everything will be okay.
Are you a religious person?
You know, I believe in God, but I don't go to church, really. I don't know, really, you know, what is religion? You know, there are so many religions out there. I was brought up Catholic. I went with my grandmother to church on Sundays. And then on Thursday, I remember we had religion in school, and the priest came, and He slugged us, he hit us, he pulled the hair up if you didn't pay attention. So I don't know, it was a different era.
What a great way of indoctrinating someone. Like if you want people to join your club, what a good way to do it, right?
You know,
but I was gonna say, the reason I ask is because I'm not very religious either, but that moment on the bridge where you say, you know what, I'm gonna go back one more time, see what happened, that could be interpreted as divine intervention.
All right, you say it
could
first.
Be.
To me, I thought it was like the scene in Officer and a Gentleman, where Richard Gere has run out of options.
Yes.
But it's like Officer and Gentleman with much better food.
Yes.
This documentary, it's such.
Or It's a Wonderful Life.
It is. It's a.
You were literally on the bridge like him. Did you ever see that movie? It's a Wonderful Life.
That.
Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, wait, Jimmy Stewart. Oh, my God.
He probably came to Spago.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
I actually have a good picture of him.
Yes.
In my office, him and his wife, Gloria, I think so. And he was very nice, yeah.
Talking about Spago, we were talking on the elevator down. Wolfgang got us coffee, so we're really settled right now. We're good. Yeah. But on the elevator down, Phil and I were talking. I said, I remember when my father, you know, may he rest in peace, but when my father came to L.A., we went, two things that were stood out as life moments. We went to see Sinatra, who was his hero, and we went to Spago and he saw Wolfgang. And I remember thinking from your evil stepfather to the fact that you have given fathers and sons and mothers and daughters that moment, like going to Spago the first time was, I come from the rock journalism world, so I know rock stars. That was more, you were more of a rock star in Spago than most rock stars.
Absolutely.
I love rock stars too, so I have something in common with your father. Hopefully you like rock and roll too.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Because I remember when I opened Cut, you know, I said, okay, I'm going to do my playlist, what I like to hear. So I put on rock and roll, everybody from Pink Floyd, which is more, you know, quiet, to crazy ones and everything. And then one lady called me, Wolfgang, what's wrong with the music here? Because it was pretty loud. And I said, oh, you love the music. So I went and turned it up even louder. So the next time she saw me at Spago, she said, I love Cut, but the music is terrible. And I said, well, I love it. And Oprah Winfrey loves it. So I don't know, why not you?
I got emotional during the documentary because the dish that you keep referring back to is your Wiener Schnitzel.
Yeah.
And you put it on the menu at Spago, even though it doesn't really go with the other food at Spago, you said, to hell with it. I love it. It's my touchstone. It's my childhood. It's my comfort food. I'm putting this and a few other dishes from my Austrian roots onto the menu. Now, you just happen to hit a nerve with a lot of people, including my father, who I'm not sure if you remember, but he would come and he ordered it all the time. There was one time when it wasn't on the menu for some reason.
Yeah.
And my dad was disappointed, to say the least. When you came out to say hello, my father said, why isn't the Wiener Schnitzel on the menu? You said, you want Wiener Schnitzel? You got it. And you went in the back. Wolfgang personally made my dad Wiener Schnitzel.
All right, see? Well,
getting a little choked up because he loved it so much. It was so sweet of you to do. There's a certain hospitality and love that you have for the people that come, and you seem very grateful that they're there. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You seem so loving and kind, and you want to say hi to everybody, and you understand your role in the world, and especially at your restaurant, and what a big deal it is for you, being the most famous chef in the world, to come over to anybody's table and make them feel special is a gorgeous thing. But to go above and beyond that and make an old man from New York his favorite thing, you can't underestimate the impact that has on a person, even on our relationship, mine with my father, that I could give him that evening, right? Because of you. So thank you, Wolfgang.
Oh, my God. Thank you. I think, I don't know if you have to give you a Kleenex or some food or something.
If we have any food, I'll take that. You know me. You know me. I'm.
While we're weeping, one more.
Yes.
Just to give to what I, because you see a documentary or you can hear a story from another famous person like Phil. I will tell you something. I don't have a long relationship with Wolfgang, but I work on a lot of big events and award shows and things. So I've been backstage watching this man, you know, do things, especially for charitable events. And the one that means the most to me is, because I lost my dad to Alzheimer's, there's an event in Vegas, a major event that he helped bring to life. There's a Larry Ruvo and Camille Ruvo in Vegas, who were, they do a thing called Keep Memory Alive for the Cleveland Clinic Lou Ruvo Center. And so he can tell you about that, but I will just tell you that my seat is by the prompter as the stars come on and I talk about what they're going to say. It also happens to be where 500 servers are preparing dessert for 1,000 people. And the amazing thing is year after year, watching this guy for a charitable event, personally speak incredibly kindly to every staff member to sort of check on every dessert, like looking, and at a point where a lot of people, we both have seen people who stop caring.
Yes.
And I think that's how you sustain, but I've seen you, and I never saw you do anything other than speak nicely and get make sure the job is done.
Well, I tell you one thing, good that you brought that up. I think in 2 weeks or something, we are doing an event at Spago for Alzheimer's and brain health, actually for the Lou Ruvo Center in Las Vegas. And Andrea Pocelli is performing.
Nice.
Oh, so we're going to have a big benefit. Oh, I don't know how much the tickets are. I'm sure it's going to be a good amount of money. But to have Andrea Pocelli singing and it's going for, you know, brain health, brain research for people who have all kinds of brain diseases, I think it's really a good thing. And I always considered myself lucky to be successful, you know, work for it. Nothing, I didn't have nothing when I started, but to give something back. You know, in the old time at Spago, we started the first food and wine festival where chefs got together.
The best food event in the country.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
Can we do it again?
Would I think it, we should it do it again.
You I know, think it's great.
I have so many chefs from all over the place, from Alice Waters to Larry Fortune and Lydia Shire, and all the chefs said, when are we going to do that again? That was the best
so
event.
So fun.
Yeah.
Take over the back lot at Universal.
Yeah.
So it seems like an old European village, especially at night. You can feel the transformation. So you can actually believe you're in Europe with the lights and everything. And every 2 feet is another fabulous restaurant giving the food away. And it was a, it was for cancer research, I believe, right? The first one?
It was actually for Meals on Wheels, you know, which is for the old people or people who were homebound and so forth. Like at that time when we started, the AIDS thing was raging and you know, so many young people here had it. And I remember I had a friend of mine who had AIDS and really bad already. He was in a hospice already. The parents didn't want to talk to him. And then we sent him food. You know, we had like, I think, 12 vans or whatever, delivered like 3,000 meals a day. And we sent him food. And he sent me a note and says, Wolfgang, this is the best thing for me. And I almost started crying when he sent me that, you know.
Yeah.
He said, you know, they told me to eat at 11 o'clock lunch, but I cannot sleep all night long. I go to sleep at 7 in the morning. Then I wake up at 4 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And because of Meals on Wheels, I get a warm meal at home.
Great.
And I remember there was one lady, and some of you are in the movie business, they know about the Lemley.
Lemley Theaters, famous.
We delivered food to her house. She lived in East Hollywood, had a nice house.
Yes.
But she couldn't get out anymore.
Right.
But she wanted to stay in her house. So every day they brought her a tray with some warm food, nutritious food, and, you know, low in salt and everything. And so she could stay at home. And I remember each time when I went, she put makeup on to look good and everything. And she was like 90 years old.
So nice.
So
you
know, I think that what makes me feel good, really, you know, to be able to give back. And that's why we are also in the hospitality business. Yes, we are in the food business, but mainly we are in the hospitality business. So we want to make people feel good. When they leave our restaurant or wherever we do something, we want them to go home and say, wow, I had an amazing time. I can't wait to do it again.
Wolfgang, because we're at the Emma Summit, it's very, I think
there's
food coming.
Look what's happening. We don't, you know, the name of the show is Naked Lunch.
Naked lunch. Okay.
That's it. All so right, here comes a little lunch.
I saw.
And then you're going to get naked. Here, look at this. Wow.
Okay.
You people out there listening.
I thought the show was called Feed Phil.
What Somebody is Feed Phil. Yeah,
Somebody
that's my
feed
show.
Phil. All right.
Wolfgang said to make sure we feed Phil so that he doesn't get upset.
Thank you.
This is the world famous smoked salmon pizza that Wolfgang invented. What year?
In the 80s, early 80s.
David?
If I don't drop this, that'll be a miracle.
Here, get the plate.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's not fair.
Are you going to have?
I will give it to the people out there.
Here we go.
All right.
Pass it around. I wish I had enough for everybody, but luck of the draw.
Oh, my God, this is...
It's the greatest. What year did this come around?
This came around like 83 or so.
Right. And tell the story of its invention, because it's one of the world's great inventions.
Well, I think for the people who like smoked salmon, for sure.
Yes, yeah.
What happened is one day, I used to make smoked salmon. I love to make smoked salmon, and it was really delicious and everything. And one day, we ran out of brioche. We served it traditionally, like you can get it now with brioche and some dill cream and lemon and capers, whatever. And then I said, okay, we have no more bread in the house. And then I was for Joan Collins and Edgar, her husband, and some other couple who was with them. And I said, Edgar and her always loved the smoked salmon, and I had no bread. So I cooked some pizza dough and sent that out with the smoked salmon. And then as I was sending it out, I said, God, I'm just going to put it together like a lox and bagel. Yep. You know, so I cooked another disc of the pizza dough with some onions on top, some olive oil. And then when it was nice and crispy, I said, I'm going to put the dill cream on. I put the smoked salmon on, a little caviar, a little chive. I tasted it and I said, oh, it's fucking great.
And it's still fucking great.
Yeah. And so this too.
It's one of the world's best dishes. It really is. You lucky people that got a slice. What do you think?
Yeah.
Is it the first time you've had it? Really? Where have you been?
In Kansas City.
That's right.
Yeah.
Although you can probably get it there now, too, because everyone imitates it.
You know, it was so funny. I was in Lyon. I was very good friends with Paul Bocuse. Mm-hmm. May he rest in peace, too. Mm-hmm. And I go to one of his restaurants there, and I stand on the bus. We were talking, and all of a sudden, I see a smoked salmon pizza come out. And I said, what the heck? Do you do it for me? He says, no. We're doing it for our customers.
Ah.
So then he brought me his menu and he wrote on it Spago's smoked salmon pizza. So I said, what an honor, really, to have me come from France, work in many restaurants.
And I hope you sued him then.
And then got it back. I'm not in show business like you. We don't sue. We feed people.
Yeah, no, that's very nice. You never, it's true though, you never feel like it, in your whole career, that you went to a restaurant and you felt like, hey, that they took that from me. You're only flattered if that happens?
Yeah, no, totally, totally. I think, you know, if somebody wants to do it, you know, you cannot really copyright it anyway.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, people know by now where it comes from.
Right.
I know in Phoenix, I had a friend of mine who worked with me in France too, a French guy, and he make it on a crispy tortilla. He cooked a tortilla or fried it or whatever and put the cream on top and the smoked salmon. And he said, look at that. It's like we have a Mexican-style smoked salmon pizza.
Don't you love that, the mashup of cultures? And that's where the great inventions come from,
totally.
Right? Like this.
So how are we going to share? Now, should we take a slice
yes.
of this and then share it with some more
with
people?
Yes, different people, yes.
Okay, so but as we do that, Wolfgang, a question. We're at the Emma Summit. You, in addition to how we're talking a lot about how you have sustained this amazing career, how does being, thinking about being sustainable, about being environmental, how does working towards not just a great career, but to save the planet, how has that all worked in your,
your
life?
In America, we have these big words now, farm to table.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
There was no other way. I still remember as a kid when I got my first. When we got somebody brought a can of pineapple. And we opened the can and tasted the pineapple and said, oh, my God, this is amazing. Pineapples in a can. We didn't have canned food at home. So I said, I wonder how they got the pineapple in the can, you know, as a kid. So we did not have anything. But We went in the forest and picked raspberries and blueberries and blackberries and mushrooms, you name it. And, you know, my mother had a chicken coop. We got the eggs. In the springtime, she made fried chicken because all the roosters got their head cut off and fried. And the female ones could lay the eggs. They stayed. So they were spared their life. And so for me, it was always normal. So when I started Spago, I found friends down in Rancho Santa Fe, who became friends afterwards, a Japanese family, the Chino family. And I used to drive down there every week to pick up vegetables, to pick up strawberries and everything. And I still remember Sidney Poitier one time, I had this pile of strawberries and he looked at them and said, Wolfgang, what did you do to these strawberries? And I said, what do you mean? Nothing. We just picked them up this morning at the farm. And I said, taste it. And he said, oh my God, I never tasted strawberries like that.
Wow.
And it's true, at that time, there was no farmer's market in Los Angeles. Now you have them all over. And I think Harry's Berries became more famous than anybody with their strawberries. But at that time, there was nothing. So the son, Frank, from the son of the owners of the ranch, he drove up on Sunday and he was really excited to see some movie stars. And he walked behind and was making pizzas. And I always said, why you don't open a little pizza stand next to your farm stand down there? So it was really very special. And to me, that was always important. And still it's today to really support the farmers out there. Because I grew up on a farm. And when you look at today, just like in many other businesses, all these big factories, farms are taking over where they plant thousands of acres of one crop, which is really not good for the soil. You know, they plant it year in and year out. And they add so much artificial stuff in it, which is not good. And so I think to really support small farmers, that was always for me a way to go. You know, I was always really trying to help them along. And I said, I don't want to have somebody who is sitting in an office somewhere taking orders from a restaurant and then sending them out, make the money. I want the farmers to make the money. And I still remember at the Chino farm, we got this beautiful white corn. And I took my mother there. I said, you have to taste the corn. She said, you eat corn raw like that? I said, this is so good, so sweet. So she tasted it and says, oh my God, this is amazing. So I gave her some seeds to take it back to Austria because we had corn in Austria, but only for the animals. They fed the cows and whatever with it. So she took it back and grew corn there. And then the neighbors grew white corn. And then all of a sudden, the tiny little village with 10 houses, everybody was having white corn. And some steamed it, some grilled it, and some ate it raw. So it was amazing.
I have two bits of good news. One is that Phil and I are getting on a plane, so we can't afford to have the dessert. So we will leave that for you, which is great, except for maybe the macaroons. I believe you're a macaroon lover, so we might take a few of those. But the other good news is we want to hear some of your questions in just a few minutes. So think about that, and then Phil, you.
There's a great story in the documentary about how your world famous frozen pizza came to be.
Yeah, I know. You know, it was. Everything had to be fresh. Everything had to be the best. I used to go to the fish market where all the Japanese chefs went because at that time, there were not as many. Nobu wasn't here yet with this restaurant. So I used to go downtown to the market and then the same to the farmer's market. And Johnny Carlson was our regular guest. He used to come every Friday night after taping the show with his girlfriend then, Alex, for dinner. And a few times he orders like 10 pizzas to go. And finally I said, Johnny, what the fuck are you doing with 10 pizzas?
That's how you talk to him?
Yeah. And then he looks at me and said, what do you mean? I said, what do you do? You want to have a party tonight? He says, no, I put it in my freezer. And then when I'm hungry playing cards, my housekeeper, he warms them up in the oven and it's just as good as yours here.
Wow.
I said, you know what? That's the last time I give you a pizza to go. That's it.
Yeah.
So then finally I said, okay, I'm going to try just what he's talking about. So I tried the pizza, cooked it like perfectly and put it in the freezer and take it out again. I said, yeah, it's a little overcooked. Then I cooked another one, cooked it just halfway through.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? he is right. It's not that bad. So then we started making frozen pizza for some Vincente Foods and a few other stores around here. And then little by little, we started this pizza business, frozen pizza business.
I love it. Not only was Johnny Carson the king of late night,
yeah,
and the king of frozen pizza.
He gave me the idea. And you know, often in life, you get a little idea here and there, and it's really, then you follow it through. Now, you know, a lot of young people have great ideas, but following through is a different story. You know, I tell that to my children. I said, I have this idea. Let's do this. I said, do it. But very few people actually have the stamina or have the endurance to follow through and do it actually.
You're just amazing. You've always been amazing. One of the things in the documentary that I love that was brought out is exactly how I feel. I think you became so famous that it almost hurt your reputation as a great chef because they see you as a star, some people, and not as a great chef. And I'm here to say, just as everyone in the documentary says, you're one of the best chefs in the world. He's still one of the best chefs in the world. He is phenomenal. When we have events sometimes, charity events, where some of the other giant names chefs are cooking alongside you. So in other words, they make a dish, you make the second course. They make a dish, you make the fourth course. Whatever it is, everyone is represented. Who's the best? Whose dish is the best? Always Wolfgang. Really?
And we've done two episodes with chefs so far.
Yeah.
Roy Choi, Nancy Silverton. You've come up with nothing but the ultimate admiration of whatever chef we speak to. It just comes up as sort of the, you know, the Sinatra of the chef.
By the way,
I want to be the weekend of the chef.
Would you settle for the Drake of the chef? No, we'll give you a weekend.
Absolutely. That's fine.
Okay, so any questions, people, for the... Please raise your hand if you have a question for the weekend of food. over there, please.
Oh, I sort of had a personal question. I'm just wondering if your stepfather ever lived long enough to have witnessed the success that
good question.
We want to repeat the question, Phil?
Did your stepfather live long enough to get his comeuppance in your success?
You know what? It's what is amazing to hear. When he saw that the restaurants were successful, you know, he passed away in 2007.
Oh.
So the last time he was in America was 2003. So I was already, you know, fairly well established. But he thought it was all because of him. He said, you know, if I would not have been so hard on you, you would be just like all the other guys in town in the little village where we are, and they have nothing going on. So he said, you know what? Thank God I was beating you up and beating up your sister.
Thank you for the abuse. Yes, thank you.
So I think it was an interesting thing that he actually took the credit, and he went even farther. He stormed into the governor's office in Klagenfurt and says, you have to build a statue for my son, for Wolfgang. And then all of a sudden, I became his favorite kid.
Really?
By the time I was 50 already or something like that.
So that's very sweet that he was an asshole to the end. Anyone else? Yes, right there.
We have a question here in the back. Oh, over here.
That's all right. We'll get to you. Yeah. Hi.
Hi, my name's Dan. Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. I've been running film production studios for many years, and I'm currently building the greenest studio in the world called Electric Owl Studios. One thing I'm struggling with is catering in film and TV and what happens at the end of a meal for cast and crew when there's leftover food. And I'm wondering, you've done so much catering in your career. Is there some sort of answer to that question of where does the food go? There's certain laws that, you know, people can't take it or Have you, you've obviously had to deal with that.
Well, I think you really have to be organized to get it somewhere, you know, on Skid Row or Project Angel Food, or there are a lot of organizations who will come and pick up the food. But it has to be in the proper containers. It has to be stored properly. So you just cannot say, okay, this is the leftover, take it like that. Then they don't want it. So we do, for example, at the Oscars, you know, where we have to prepare for 1,600 people, we have leftover, and we send it to organizations like Project Angel Food and things like that. So that way, these people who don't have even a meal, they can eat like George Clooney.
Great, great.
We had a question back in this, back there.
Hi, thank you so much. It's really amazing to hear all your three stories, and thank you for sharing everything. I just have a quick question about sustainability in the food industry. In my personal experience, I find that dealing with changing food and advocating for more sustainable food or plant-based food tends to be the most sensitive in many ways, because there are so many cultural aspects to food. Cultures are very steeped in, you know, the food that they eat. So how do you navigate asking someone to sort of change and rethink how they eat to be more sustainable or to be more environmentally conscious, while also being sensitive to the vast cultural differences that we face among food?
Yeah, well, I think it's very simple. As I said before, I always try to support the local people wherever I am, you know, and I always said, if I'm interested in the people, in the local people, they will become customers probably. It's just a normal thing. If I buy from the farmer the strawberries or the apples or whatever, he will say, oh, you know, maybe one day I'm going to go for my birthday, come to Spago or Cut or to any of these restaurants, you know, for dinner. So for sure, it is not easy. Do I have everything local? No. Unless you can grow me white truffles in October, November, I have to buy them from Italy because I love them.
Yeah.
So could I live without them? Yes, I can. But still, you know, we are a luxury restaurant, so certain things we have, not local, but we try to get as much local, as many local ingredients as possible. But it's difficult in other places. In California, we can get so many things all year round. Now, if you have a restaurant in Chicago or in Kansas City or somewhere where, you know, from November until March, it's frozen, you have to bring in some things. Or you do like what my mother did. In the summer, in spring and fall, we ate vegetables. In the wintertime, we ate potatoes,
yeah.
We ate rice, and my mother made really good homemade pasta.
Yeah.
I never saw green beans in the winter, in February, in my house, or a salad. We didn't have it. We just had what we had at that time because the city was too far away. We didn't have a car, no nothing. So I'm lucky here in LA where I live. I take my children to the farmer's market. I let them talk to the farmers and everything. I let them taste the food from the farmers. So that way, when I came home I make a big steamed vegetable plate with a little olive oil, a little sea salt, maybe a little pepper for me. And they eat the vegetables just like I do. And why? Because they didn't learn how to eat, you know, just French fries. Now they are in school somewhere. Their friends take them out. Like one of our sons is in Switzerland in boarding school. For sure, they go to the local joint and, you know, they have French fries, hamburgers, whatever, most of them what they eat at school. But at least when they grew up, you know, I always try to explain them. It is important that you know where the food comes from. The same thing, our idea was always about animals. And already early on, our slogan was, because I went to every animal farm to where we get lamb or beef, whatever. So I always said, you know, I want to know how you treat what we eat. And I think to me, that was just as important to see the farm where they raise beef, where they raise lamb or chicken or anything like that.
I think one thing, though, that you understand inherently that you maybe don't think it needs to be said, but to people who aren't in the business, maybe no one will care at all about how sustainable this food is in front of them if it's not delicious.
Yeah.
Your kids would not eat those vegetables if they weren't fantastic.
You are absolutely right. But what would you rather eat? beans which were harvested a day ago and are on the farmer's market today, or tomatoes or whatever it is, or have tomatoes which each one looks perfectly red, perfectly the same size. I don't know what God they're praying to have tomatoes like that, because I never saw a garden with tomatoes
but
like that.
But until you bite it and you realize it tastes like a styrofoam.
Exactly. Or even melons. You know, when you get the melons, they taste like the carton. The apple is the same.
Yes.
You know, I don't know. They pick them so unripe, they have almost no flavor. So for me, it's a joy now to go to the farmer's market, find the first nectarines and peaches and great cherries and so forth. And I told our chef over at the Bel Air Hotel, I don't know, he put apple salad on it. I said, don't you know apples are ripe in September and October and not in May or June? And then he says, oh, you're right, chef. Where I grew up, we didn't have apples in May and June. They had to be bought from a supermarket.
Right. You know?
But the farmers didn't have them. So I said, pay attention what is in season. Pay attention what is available at your local farmer's market. And that's why I love Japanese food a lot.
Yeah.
Their fish, their vegetables, each one has the season. When they are at their best, that's when they use it.
Right. But we're so used to in America getting exactly what we want whenever we want it.
Exactly. I remember still one time we didn't have raspberries or strawberries. They were not good enough for my taste.
Yeah.
And when I took them off the menu, and people yelled at me and says, what do you mean you don't have strawberries? I had them at Jason last week, and I told them, yeah, it probably tastes like shit. And they loved it. Sorry, but I want strawberries, you know.
Yes, right.
Phil,
right.
I want to ask you one question.
Okay.
When this is the Emma Impact Summit, when you think about the impact, when I watched the documentary, what hit me was the impact of one man from a tough childhood on the world of food,
and
on the world generally. Can you think of a chef who's had more of a positive impact on the world?
No, and also, it's not just... That's okay.
That was actually the cell phone of the head...
Exactly. It's not just how great Wolfgang is, but he's also, and you'll see in the documentary, the influence he's had on other chefs and the mentorship. Talk about the people who've come through your restaurant that you've nurtured and encouraged. People like Nancy Silverton and rest his soul, Mark Peel, and Sherry Yard was your pastry chef, and so many. Tell us about them, and also, I want to know who you love now. Who are the up-and-comers?
There are too many. If I forget one, the guy said, Wolfgang, you don't like me anymore.
You can just name a couple.
I think for anybody out there who has young children or young adults, whatever it is, I think it is really important to find a mentor, to find somebody who is really passionate about what they do. And I think for me, it was at Beaumanière. When I was there, the owner and chef was 72 years old. And... he was in the kitchen and in the dining room. It was a three-star restaurant, but he was so passionate about doing it right. And to me, I said, I want to be like him. I want to have a restaurant like him. Now, I never had a three-star restaurant, and that's one of the things I said, maybe I should try to do one. But his passion rubbed up on me, and then I said, I want to be like him one day. And I remember he went into the dining room and came back. He was very smart. He was also painting and everything, like a Renaissance man. And I still remember when he brought Elizabeth Taylor in the kitchen, and one day Marcello Mastroianni and Catherine Deneuve came in the kitchen.
Wow.
And us young chefs were looking, oh my God, the most beautiful women in the world are coming in the kitchen.
I want to be a chef like
him. For sure, I want to be like him. You know? But it was mostly about the food, because he had six gardeners. He owned some land there, and where they grew all the vegetables, fruits and things like that right there, because it was in Le Beau de Provence and there was no train there. There was nothing there. If we want fish, we had to go to Marseille. If we want cream and butter, somebody had to go to Lyon to pick it up there. So you really did not have that much except what you had around you. I remember November was slow. We went and picked olive and we made pressed olives and made olive oil. So it was like, to us, it was so normal to have all these amazing ingredients right there. And that's, for me, was the most important thing. But I must tell you, there was another guy, he passed away a few years ago now, Paul Bocuse, who changed also the profession as a chef, who chefs were, because he came out of the back. in the old time, chefs were always in the back, was always the manager, they made the deal, or the restaurant owner, whatever it was. They were out in front with a nice suit. The chefs were somewhere in the back. Nobody talked about them. And in France, too, when I worked at Maxim's in Paris, was another three-star restaurant. Everybody knew Roger, who was the manager of the restaurant and maitre d' and everything, but nobody knew who the chef was, really. So when I built Spago in 1981, and 82, we opened in January, so I said, I'm going to build the kitchen right in the dining room. And that didn't exist at that time. And that's why it had such a big impact then everywhere, to have the kitchen part of the experience. And the chefs being part of the experience of what the customer have. And I think it was a total transformation where the chefs didn't think anymore, okay, they are second rate, they're in the back, they're in the cellar somewhere. They are part of the dining experience. And I think then we opened Chinois, obviously it was the same. We had even people sit at the counter and some of them didn't like it because I used live lobster and cut them in half and people freaked out at that time and said, what are you doing to the lobster? I said, well, you can't buy them dead, you know, and then they wouldn't be good. So I tell them I cut them as fast as I can. So, but I think that really changed our industry a lot to have the chef visible. And obviously I started to do a little TV and things like that. But I think mainly now it's almost no restaurants where they don't have an open kitchen.
That's right. People really love to see how it's entertainment now. I mean, yeah. There's a straight line from you to all the food shows. There's way too many food on travel shows, don't you think, David?
Except for Somebody Feed Phil, there's way too many.
But it looks like you'll be on hiatus for a long time. You're so damn skinny.
Oh, no. I have to.
They don't feed you.
Yeah, they feed me plenty.
Okay.
Before we go, I just want to thank you for not just how great you are as a chef, you've been so kind to me and my family over the years when I had to, Jim Brooks cast me in a movie in Spanglish, and I played a sous chef to Adam Sandler's head chef. You let me come in the kitchen at Spago and train a little bit, and yeah. You were so kind to me, and I think I saw something there that I never saw before. You had the Golden State Warriors were eating, and they you prepared for them a kind of Southern soul food menu.
Yeah.
And I said, what, you do that? You said, we can do anything.
Yeah.
And you opened this world to me and my family where we could have that dinner. we had every birthday there. My son had a birthday there, and they let little Lily, who was maybe 6 years old, back in the kitchen with Sherry to make a cake. It was so sweet. And that's who he is, though. He's a very family-oriented. If you come into Spago to this day, you feel like you're part of his family. And the food is still world-class. You are still world-class. I'm so happy to have known you all these years. I look forward to more years of knowing you and getting even closer as a friend to you, because I just think you're terrific.
No, thank you.
Wolfgang Puck, everybody.
Naked Lunch is a podcast by Phil Rosenthal and David Wild. Theme song and music by Brad Paisley. Produced by Will Sterling. Executive produced by Phil Rosenthal, David Wild, and Josephine Marcherana. Engineering support by Brendan Burns, and our consulting journalist is Pamela Chellin. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a friend. But if you can't take my word for it, take Phil's.
And don't forget to leave a good rating and review. We like 5 stars, you know.
Thanks for listening to Naked Lunch, a Lucky Bastards and Stitcher production.
Stitcher.